Yeah, so I worked over 20 years in protective custody. I've worked for from everything from little people to transgenders to ex-law enforcement, you name it, celebrities. I've worked protecting them in protective custody. So,
what is the difference between protective custody and the general population?
So the general population would be an inmate who pretty much is just a regular inmate in there for regular charges. You know, murder, robbery, burglary, everything aside from sexual crimes. And of course, you know, high profile people. They're separated from the general population because obviously numerous reasons it can become a target, you know, for extortion. If they're a celebrity, if they're, you know, say a little person, they could be subject to victimization. Homosexual, you know, they can be subject to victimization also. So, you know, also, if you're Hispanic or if you're a Hispanic inmate or a white inmate, you cannot be homosexual and walk the general population. That's the rule amongst them. So they're separated and put into protective custody. So
how did you first get into this line of work?
So everybody in my life was incarcerated. So from my father, everybody's a felon. My uncles, you know, everybody that was in my life was incarcerated. So it was kind of like I knew I was going to end up in prison one way or another. So, you know, I might as well be on the opposite on the right side, you know, on the law enforcement side, you know.
That's funny.
Yeah. So also, you know, I wanted to be a street cop. And my dad, he was in and out of incarceration. So he told me, he's like, hey, you know, and I never really thought about working the prison or the jails. And he said, why don't you become a correctional officer or a deputy sheriff, you know? So I went into that, you know, and he said, just be yourself. It'll be, you know, easy for you. So, you know, I went into college, got into took criminal justice courses, and you know, I went that route. You know, interesting story. While I was in college touring the prison and the jails, my dad was incarcerated at that time. So I was kind of embarrassed if I would see him, you know. So, you know, it was kind of interesting.
Did you see him on that tour?
No, thank goodness, because our professor was a deputy sheriff. So, you know, I didn't want to tell him, obviously. So I was just kind of sneaking around, kind of, you know, trying to be out of the way. And, you know, so I would speak to my dad. I would visit him weekly. So he told me, you know, I said, hey, I might be there. So, you know, if you see me, don't. But I know him, he would have been like, hey, you know, so, you know, but fortunately, I did not see him. I think he was in administrative segregation at the time. So, you know, I didn't have to see him. Thank goodness, you know.
How did you grow up? Tell me about your childhood.
So growing up, I was born in Los Angeles here in East Los Angeles. And about 3 years old, we moved to San Diego, California. I was told, you know, by my mother, my uncles who were prominent members in a gang here in Los Angeles didn't approve of her and my father's relationship. So we moved to San Diego kind of as a new start for them. So grew up in specifically National City, California, which was also, you know, pretty. So my mom also told us that she didn't want us growing up in Los Angeles because, you know, the gang problems and she was, you know, all the family were in gangs and they didn't want us around that. My father was a gang member. Everybody around me was. So she said she didn't want us growing up around there. So San Diego was going to be a fresh start, you know. So, but, you know, it was kind of, you moved us to another, you know, rough neighborhood, inner city of San Diego. So, you know, growing up, we were on welfare Section 8. But I was fortunate enough about when I was young, my mom became, you know, she became a Christian, so she wanted us to go to Christian school. So she worked out a deal with the owner of this school in our neighborhood. It was very small, maybe 200 students. She worked out a deal where she would do the after-school daycare, and she would clean the school in return for me and my sister tuition. So fortunately, we were able to attend private school. But it was a very different. Most of these kids were upper to middle class to upper middle class kids. So, you know, we do a lot of field trips and things like that. And the field trips, a lot of times we would unable to attend because we didn't have money. We're on welfare, Section 8. Everybody there had, you know, was pretty upper middle class, you know, so they had the money to do these. Like Disneyland, we do SeaWorld, Disneyland, Universal Studios. Sometimes we'd be able to attend. A lot of times people would pay for us. They'd say, hey, we'll pay for you. But, you know, it was kind of, it was cool, but it was kind of sad too because we didn't have money to like, we'd just take our sack lunch and we're drinking out of the fountain, you know. So this is, but, you know, I got to see another part of life. If I had not been able to attend private school, I don't think I would have seen that other, that would have gave me the drive for me, my brother, and my sister that we have, you know, that too, because it showed us another part of life. You know, so we'd go to these kids' houses, you know, they had nice houses. Like I said, we're living in, you know, in the rough neighborhood on Section 8 welfare. We're in the welfare line all day. You know, back then they were giving out the government cheese and, you know, the powdered milk and all that. So, you know, and, you know, that was unfortunate, but, you know, it kind of gave me a drive to make something of my life. You know, I did well in school. I was an honorable student. Me and my sister, we did pretty well. I was able to graduate early at 16, started attending junior college, like accelerated classes. So I always knew in the back of my head that, you know, I wanted to get into law enforcement. So, you know, I was able to graduate early, start attending college. And like I said, and within law enforcement, I have been seeing a lot of people who grew up with my background. You know, like I said, you know, my dad and all my family incarcerated, you know. I didn't even tell a lot of people, you know, my story. And if I did, they wouldn't have even known how we carried ourselves, you know, within our family. We try to, you know, try to hide that part of our life, you know. But, you know, so when I'm about 16, 17, I'm working at one of my friends from school gave me a job at a high-end restaurant in Coronado, California. I'm a dishwasher. You know, I start out dishwasher. I'm like 16, 17 at the time, you know. And I'm working there for about 2 years now. And one of the regional managers, I believe he's regional or store manager, he approaches me and he says, asks me, hey, can you get something that's now perfectly legal in the state of California? Okay. So, and it was a total shock to me because I thought I was in trouble when he asked to speak to me. He's like the regional manager. I'm like, oh man, what'd I do wrong? You know? So he approaches me and says, you know, can I get this thing that is perfectly legal in the state of California now? So I'm about 17, 18. And I said, well, let me check, you know? So I check, I start asking my friends and asking around, you know, and they point me in a direction and I get involved in that for a while. Like I said, it's perfectly legal now. You know, so that opened up a whole nother, my eyes into a whole nother. I didn't know people in this neighborhood did things like that. You know, it was kind of a shock to me, but you know, I got along well with them and, you know, I was able to, I facilitate them, but like I said, as far as it was a, you know, different part of my life, you know, and I see why people can go to another direction. I did it obviously because I seen a route to make money, I could see how easily the trajectory of your life can change, you know, because you know I seen the opportunity, you know, I took it, and with that came, you know, a lot of other, you know, a lot of things, you know, but like I felt like it was, you know, it wasn't bad. It was going to be legal someday. I knew that. But, you know, so I got involved in that. And, but, you know, I could see now I can't judge people because I could see how easily the trajectory of your life can change, you know, in the back of my head, I always knew I wanted to be in law enforcement.
What made you want to get into this?
When I was a kid, I would watch Chips, things like that. I wanted to be in law enforcement. I thought it was a good career. Thought it would be an easy transition for me. Growing up, how I grew up, I knew I could deal with these individuals, you know, in the streets or in prison. This is what I've been around my whole life. So mm-hmm. I knew that it would be something I could handle, you know, and like I said, I was always into Chips and, you know, I liked Poncherello you know. I thought, you know, he was in shape, good looking, you know, he got all the women. So I kind of gravitate towards that. And as a kid, you know, when my dad would get pulled over and taken to jail at times, I would say, "Hey, Dad, Chips is behind us," you know. And he said, "Oh, man," you know, and this is back in the early 80s. You know, he'd get pulled over and he'd have a tall can in his lap. And, you know, the cop would, you know, back then they would say, "Hey, you know what, just go ahead, give me your ID, your driver's license, walk home." And, you know, he, you know, the cop didn't want to deal with us and everything, the kids in the car. So, you know, he would, you know, let us pretty much walk home. But as soon as my dad would see the officer leave, he would, you know, jump back in the car and we'd drive home. That's how it was in the early 80s, you know, no seatbelt, you know. And so, you know, none of my interactions with law enforcement at that time were negative. So I kind of, you know, looked up to them. A couple of times when they did take them in, you know, they would give us, you know, sticker, a candy, take us home, you know. "Where can we take you?" "Oh, the neighbor's house," you know. We, you know, so that's how it was back then. So, you know, kind of looked up to law enforcement. Like I said, I never had no negative interactions with them. You know, even though all my family were criminals, they never spoke badly of them.
Is there a big difference between law enforcement, you know, being on the right side of the law and the wrong side? What's the difference?
I mean, you know, yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of people say, "Hey, you just joined another gang," you know, being a correction officer. But no, I mean, you know, it's a, I mean, we, you know, some people can get it, you know, confused. Like we, you know, we do not, you know, like they don't like other officers that speak on them. You know, we just, you know, I had my own set of rules that I wouldn't cross, you know. I never felt, you know, good taking advantage of somebody. They're in a position where we have the upper hand. So I've never been that kind of person, a bully or, you know, somebody who takes, you know, excitement and, you know, and already kicking somebody when they're down. So
how old were you when you started?
I was 24. So 24 years old, you know, like I said, I grew up around a life of crime, you know, and I, like I said, I felt it was going to be an easy transition into going into this career field. And, you know, one of the benefits is a medical and the retirement, you know, I mean, even at a young age, I started thinking this is what I need. You know, in my life to someday retire and, you know, retire relatively early. You could retire at 50. So I've been retired now. So, you know, yeah, that's.
How many years were you?
I did almost 26 years.
26 years as, yes. As a guard.
And
as a CEO, they call it.
As a correction officer, correct. Yeah. And over 20 of that was working protective custody. From 2000 to 2006, I worked regular institutions. Level 3 and 4 general population. One was out in Blythe, California, which is near the Arizona-California border, about 15 minutes from the border. It was a regular level 3 general population institution. And to be honest, I didn't really have no problems there. At that time, early 2000s, maybe 60% of the population was Hispanic from Southern California. So I got along well with them. You know, they approached me. Once they know that you're going to be the regular officer, they approach you and they say, "Hey, you know, what's your pet peeves?" They look, you know, they want to just do their easy time and, they approach you and, you know, and I said, "Look, this is my pet peeves. You know, if you have any," and they told me, "Well, if you have any issues with any of our people, we'll take care of it." So, you know, I know sometimes they say it's not the right way to work, but I mean, you know, that it kind of made my career easier. So, you know, and they would watch out to see, you know, if they see me talking to somebody or yelling at them, they would intervene and say, "Hey, you know what, we'll take care of it for you," you know? So, honestly, it was pretty, my first 6 years, I mean, from when I say regular prison things, you know, riots, homicides, though, that was a pretty much, it went on there. And, so my first homicide was about 2001, about a year in. And we had we used to have a sponsored pizza sales. So they would sell pizzas from, example, Domino's Pizza. That day, I believe it was Domino's Pizza. They can come in and the Domino's would come in. The proceeds would go to a charity of the inmate's choice. They'd vote on this. So they did it for, let's just say, example, Wounded Warriors. They would give the proceeds to them. So anyways, that day we had a Domino's Pizza sale, and supposedly from what we heard is this particular inmate, he owed the Southern Hispanics money, so he did not pay, but he bought numerous pizzas. This is what we were told. And when he went out to yard that night, he was murdered. So that was witnessing my first homicide. You know, from what they say, he was stabbed over like 70 times, and you know, so that was when it kind of got, you know, real to me. I was like, man.
When they saw that he had money, but he wasn't giving out.
I guess that was that was the rumor. So
they were probably talking about what, $5, $10.
No, I heard he had a pretty big debt on the yard, so. You know, they couldn't let that slide, I guess, you know, so, you know, he was eliminated, but, yeah. And then, you know, numerous, you know, little, you know, we had riots and, you know, like when I say regular prison stuff, you know, that's normal, you know.
What was a prison riot like to be in?
It's pretty scary, you know, especially like in Blythe, California, it's like 100 and sometimes over 120. So you have a riot, you got pepper spray, tear gas being rounds firing from the, you know, from the tower. It's pretty rough, you know. I mean, and I would feel bad for those guys. They're cuffed up, they're zip tied. We'd zip tie everybody on the yard, strip them out naked, search them, and we're talking concrete is hard, you know, it's hot, so they'd be sitting there sometimes for hours while the investigation units would do their investigations. So you know, I could only imagine how it was for them. You know, it was probably pretty rough. But for us, too, you know, we're standing out there for hours on end while they do their crime scene and all that. You know, because sometimes two people do get, you know, great bodily injury or murdered, you know, during these riots. So it's pretty scary. You know, you got the alarms going off and, you know, it's pretty wild, to say the least, you know.
And you worked at which prisons?
Okay, so I started in 2000 at Ironwood State Correctional Facility in Blythe, California. I did about 4 years there and almost 2 years at Sentinella State Prison in the Pearl Valley. That's a level 3, level 4 prison. And to be honest, like in those general population 3 and 4 prisons, I didn't really have no issues. Personally, I didn't have no issues. I had pretty easy time. Everyone, you know, got to know me. Like I said, I felt I knew I had I had an advantage because I grew up around this. I knew how they act, how the tricks they play, you know, because, like I said, all my family was incarcerated. I had an uncle in prison for murder. One of my uncle, he was in and out of prison for numerous crimes. You know, so I knew pretty much everything. My dad was in and out of incarceration. So I pretty much knew how to deal with these guys, you know, easy to talk to. You know, I never had no issues there. So in 2006, I got to Donovan. I was trying to get closer to San Diego, California. So I got to Donovan Correctional Facility. It is a level 3 and 4, what they call SNY. And back then it was also reception. SNY is a sensitive needs yard. Pretty much to sum it up, it's protective custody. So Donovan had a couple yards full of that, of protective custody inmates. And so when I transferred there, I had never worked around protective custody inmates. I didn't know what to expect. So coming from a level 3 and 4 general population prison, it was chaotic. It was, to say the least. We were getting so many protective custody inmates at the time. A lot of individuals were dropping out of gangs and they didn't want to be part of it no more. So this is 2006. Also, state of California was heavy on locking everybody up. So we had everything crowded. Our gyms were crowded. Our day rooms. We had 40 inmates living in the day rooms, aside from the 200 inmates that lived in the cells. So they housed 20 and 20 on each side of the day room in bunk beds. And so I happened to work the first protective custody reception building. So reception is when you come into prison, you're assessed. You're only supposed to be there for 90 days, but we were so crowded and so short staffed that individuals would do sometimes 2 years in there, and you have nothing, no TV, no radio. That's, you know, while they're assessing where they're going to send you. So I worked the first protective custody reception building, which housed right away. We got 240 inmates. And so it just started a snowball. It was just, you know, and then they opened another and then another because protective custody at the time was getting so, so popular. You know,
how much more difficult is it for the guards when you're?
It's working protective custody at that time. Very rough because we also had the mentally ill. They couldn't be around regular inmates, so they send them to our unit.
That's got to be really tough.
Yes, it's because you're now telling a gang member to live with a mentally ill person. Because when you become protective custody, you can't choose no more what race you live with, what religion, nothing. It's wherever you sign up a piece of paper saying that you will live with whoever. There's exceptions, even within protective custody, nobody wanted to live with the sex offenders, So, I would tell them, hey, unfortunately, this is where you live now. And, try to find somebody to move to. I try to be sympathetic. I'll try to move them. I say, hey, you go find somewhere you want to live and I'll make it happen. So, that's how I dealt with that. But yeah, within there, within that housing unit, we had everything from, transgenders, little people, ex-cops, even ex-correctional officers, ex-doctors. We had pretty much everything within that unit. So it was pretty rough working in there. You had to learn how to deal with all these people that I had never dealt with, the mentally ill, and a lot of them, they'd get overlooked, so they come and tell me, I was like, this guy hasn't came out of his cell, I have to go check on him. You had people kicking the door, screaming. They were going to commit suicide. We had to be on top of everything in that unit. It was a whole nother beast.
What are some of the toughest things you've been through?
Me personally, I've been assaulted, but nothing major. Like I said, I always carried myself well. Always tried to stay in somewhat shape, ready for, situations like that. But I spoke well, so I never really had too many incidents as far as happened to me. Obviously, sometimes some guys are just mentally ill and they will lash out on you. I've had that happen, but usually, I haven't had anything like serious.
Is it hard not to let the work affect you when you come home to your
apartment? Yeah. Right? Yeah. I mean, I always felt, maybe I always felt I had a good work life balance, you drink a little bit, but I always exercise too to try to stay, keep my mind clean. But yeah, back in 06, you were doing 80 hours of overtime a month, whether you wanted to or not. They would just call you and say, hey, you're staying. Okay, you don't have no choice. That's another thing a lot of people don't understand when you become a correction officer. Once you go in, you might not go home. So they say, hey, you're staying another shift. And, if you're lucky, you got to pick your poison. You got to pick the position you go to. But if not, we kind of just knew we were going to stay. So we'd pick our spot. We'd say, hey, we'll stay right here in our own unit or, somewhere like that. So where we wanted to work, we just pick our own poison.
And you'll get bikers, you get murderers, you get gang members.
In protective custody, I believe in 06, 07, there was a specific biker gang that could not be around the southern Mexicans at that time. So they had to go protective custody also. So we dealt with them. They're a pretty big group out of California. They had, I guess, issues within the prison system, So, yeah, they were also in protective custody for that reason. And, a lot of guys, they don't want to go protective custody because they know they're going to be around these kind of inmates, like I said, it's kind of rough for them, And when they get there, they're already upset because they don't want to be there. But, they made choices within there that they end up there. Majority of it, well, a lot of it at that time was a lot of drug debts, They couldn't pay and, like things like that, like they couldn't afford to pay the debt. So they go to different prisons until, eventually catches up to them and then they'd end up in protective custody.
And the prisoners with sex offenses, what kind of things will happen to them if they?
We've seen it, I've seen them, even within protective custody, they can be victimized. And I've seen that, hit in the head with a rock. I've seen them stabbed within the protective custody, because even the other inmates, they despise them. They don't want to be around them. So, you know, a lot of times they will, if like a lot of times they want to get off of that yard. So they would pick them as a victim. They'd say, you know, I seen for no reason. They're just, you know, I want to leave this yard. So they pick them as a victim. They figure, why not? You know, I already got life or life without, or, you know, so they'll pick them as a victim and, you know, they would, you know, stab me.
That's a thing, right? Whereas a prisoner who's got life in prison has nothing to lose, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's what most people think, but most of them are, you know, they've accepted their fate and they're okay with, you know, they want to be most comfortable as they can be, you know.
Committing another murder isn't going to set them back anymore.
No. I think now it's only maybe 6 months in administrative segregation. It's like 6 months now, I think. And you get a tablet, a TV. You know, it's not that bad. You know, back then it was a little bit worse. You know, you'd maybe go like a year or 2 years in security housing unit separated. So really now that's one thing that is kind of scary within the prison. There's really no repercussions for them. If they do kill another inmate, I've seen, you know, had them, they're just like, hey, you know what? Had guys kill another inmate because they didn't want to go home because they were scared. And, you know, I'm like, that's crazy. We've had to extract guys out of their cell, tell them they're paroling, but they've been incarcerated for 30 years. They don't have nothing. Everyone in their family's dead. You know, they told me, I have nothing to go home to.
The real world frightens.
Yeah. And so they were, you know, a lot of times, that's another thing, you know, if they wanted to get off the yard or something, they know if they victimize a correction officer, if they assault him from behind or whatever, they would be able to stay, you know. So that's kind of one thing that's kind of scary. You know, it could just be you're the officer working that day and they pick you to assault, you know. So that's kind of a...
Have you had things like that happen?
I've seen it happen. It didn't happen to me, you know, fortunately. But yeah, I've seen officers and, you know, within the prison, it's also, you know, like, it's like prey, you know, predator prey mentality. So sometimes they'll pick a female or, a officer who look, you know, out of shape and, you know, like old and, you know, and I'd just be like, why'd you do that? They're like, well, he looked like an easy target, you know, unfortunately, you know, so, but yeah, that would happen sometimes.
Does the setup in the prison, you know, leave room for any kind of rehabilitation?
Now it is. Now it's a big focus because I actually worked the substance abuse program. I actually went and did some training from a professor from UCSD. We did like a three-day training with him about, you know, addiction and things like that. He's like world-renowned psychiatrist. And he gave us like a three-day course because I was working in that program. So actually, you know, I enjoyed working in that program. We had good mentors. That was one of the last places I worked before I left. Not the last, but one of the last. I worked there for about a year. But they were mandated to go. So, you know, a lot of times they had to either go to school, to drug substance abuse classes, work. You know, they have to do something. You can't just not work. So, you know, a lot of them were forced to go in there. And a lot of them would tell me, I didn't have a drug problem. You know, I sold drugs. And I say, well, you know, they put you in here, so, you know, you have to, you know. And, I try to motivate them to come because, you know, they wanted us, if he didn't attend, to write him like an infraction. So within the prison system, it's called a 115. It's an infraction that potentially can get you more time or loss of privileges. So, you know, I try to speak to them and talk them into coming to class, you know. And, you know, sometimes it works. Sometimes they would say, I don't care, write me up. I said, I don't want to write you up. You know, I want you to come to class. It's easy. It's 1 hour, a couple hours. Come on, man. So, you know, I try to convince them. I talk to the mentors so that within that system, they have inmate mentors that go to pretty good training to be able to assist them and speak to the other inmates. I'd have them come in and talk to him, tell him, you know, the advantages of coming to the class. So,
are there drugs getting snuck into the prison?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people talk about, you know, is there dirty staff? You know, that's probably like maybe 5 to 10% of it, but you got visits, contact visits, you know, so, I've seen people's mothers get, you know, arrested in the visiting. Unfortunately, you know, they convince their mom or their girlfriend to bring them drugs. And the majority of it comes from there, from their visits, their contact visits. Cause you can't watch everything. I mean, you got all these, maybe probably about 30, 40 guys in the visiting room, maybe three officers. So you can't watch everything. You know, obviously they pass it through their mouth, whatever way they pass it. But yeah, there's no problem getting drugs in prison, unfortunately, you know.
Handmade weapons?
Weapons, yeah. I mean, those, you know, when it was serious enough, everybody had access to a weapon if they wanted. I think most people will agree within the prison system, you know, if you want a weapon, you can get one. It's pretty easy.
And what are they making them out of?
Everything you could imagine. Bunks, desks, the metal, they grind it down. Parts of, back in the day, parts of a typewriter. Everything, I've seen everything made into a weapon. Like I said, some are good and some are real rogue. They're probably not going to do much damage, but it'll get somebody's attention, you know. And obviously, you know, if you really don't want to have a weapon like that, I've seen them put, you know, a rock in a sock and bash somebody's head in. That could do a lot of damage to you, you know. But yeah, so it's if they really want to get somebody, you can't hide from it, you know. They have all day to think of how to get you, you know, and they'll make it happen. So,
are there prisoners that stand out in your memory?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like we had, like I said, I had a, when I got there in 06, so I started working in the, you know, the protective custody reception building. So at that time, we had like volunteer, so we had 200 inmates in the cells, 40 living on the day room, 20 and 20. Everybody wanted to live in the day room because you can watch TV. We had a TV on each end of the day room. In the cells, no TV, no radio. So we had, when I got in there, we had a transgender clerk. They were just volunteers that would help us with paperwork. So we called them the clerk, you know. Clerk, porters. Porters were the ones who would clean up. And they're all volunteer. We'd handpick them. Maybe about seven guys. So when I got into the into that unit, the clerk was a transgender inmate. So when she left, she would teach the next person to be the clerk, because they'd say, hey, next Friday you're transferring to whatever prison you're going to be doing your time at. So they would train another transgender or a homosexual inmate. And an interesting inmate I had was a little person, homosexual arsonist. And it's kind of, you know, I one time I said, hey, what are you doing here? You know, why are you here? And he, which later became a she, but at the time was still a he, said, I like get drunk and I like to see the fire. And I said, that seems weird. You know, what do you get out of that? And he said, I don't know. I just liked the flames. I get drunk and that's what I like to do. So when I met him, he was in there on a parole violation. So back in 2006, the prison, they would give you a violation. You come in, they give you parole for, let's just say you got 2 years parole. Now, within that 2 years, if you did anything wrong, they would send you to back to prison and they'd assess it 3 months, 6 months, whatever the parole board decided. So he was doing a violation for having a lighter in his pocket. They gave him, I think, another year. So while we're there, Department of Forestry comes in to investigate him, and they actually take him back to court and charge him with a big fire in San Diego County. I believe that fire was about 2005 or six, but numerous people died within that fire. So he got life in prison for the arsons, you know. And like I said, you know, people used to come to the unit to see him, you know, because he looked different. You know, he had some kind of some kind of disease. So people would come in and, do you have that person, you know? And I'm like, yeah, you know, so they come in just to see. I'm like, you know, and so he, you know, he got a lot of attention because he was different, you know. And I was like, you know, but, you know, also back then they would bring the lunches into our unit. And one time I caught him in the tote. They'd bring these plastic totes that were big, and they'd bring all the lunches in there. And one time I see him on the top of the stairs, and he goes in the tote and slides down the stairs. And I'm like, don't do that. You know, if you fall and bust your head, you know, it's going to be on me, you know. So, you know, but yeah, I mean, and as far as recently celebrities, you know, I had Suge Knight on the yard. He actually did his time very well. He stayed out of the way. He'd hardly come out. He pretty much stayed out of the way. You know, he would just come to his medical appointments and things like that. And I also, before I left, you know, I was on the same yard as the Menendez brothers. They were living together in the same cell now, you know, so, but same thing with them. They pretty much stayed out of the way. I think they wanted to just, you know, do their time and everyone leave them alone, you know, so, But
the segregation that happens, are there racial gangs in prison?
Yes, definitely racial gangs. You know, within protective custody, they have gangs too. You know, they have their protective custody gangs, and they do the same thing that the other gangs do. You know, run drugs.
This is the same thing as a SHU?
No, protective custody. So there's different levels. Like I worked too for a while, a couple of years on the level 4 protective custody, and within there they had their own protective custody gangs, which is kind of odd. You know, they leave one gang and then they join another gang, but you know, I kind of understand it. It's in their nature. You know, to be a gang member, you've been doing that since you were young. So you want to feel like you belong to something. And I understand it, you know, why they do it. And it was just as violent. You know, we had same thing, same murders, assaults. It was pretty much the same, just now within the protective custody. Same thing too. Within these protective custody gangs, you couldn't be a sex offender either. You know, they wouldn't allow you to join their gang if you're a sex offender. So, I mean, they had their own rules too. Yeah. So.
And you don't bring the work home?
No, I don't think so. I think I was able to navigate it pretty well. I mean, you know, it was a big relief when I retired. It's kind of like I don't have to go back. But a lot of people, I guess do, you know, they have, you know, substance abuse problems, the big thing within the prison system is divorce, you know, and, a lot of guys get divorced. They, that's a big problem because that leads to other issues within your life, you know. So, you know, a lot of them are paying alimony, child support to different women.
There are also guys in prison who are meeting girls and getting married, right?
Correct. We've had that happen. We had one sergeant, she married an inmate, you know, she got caught and then she married him. We had it happen a couple of times, I guess they're lonely, you know, and I mean, with that being said, they weren't the most attractive officers usually, you know, so I could see why, you know, they got a little attention and they were willing to lose their job over it, you know, so, but you know, for me, being a correction officer, it wasn't a hard transition. It was a good career for me. Like I said, you're able to retire young, you get medical for the rest of your life. It's not for everybody, for sure. You know, not everybody should be there. So there's a lot of people who work there who should not be there, you know, plain and simple. But they get attracted by the pay and by the benefits. So,
Ralph, let me ask you one last question. What would you say is the most important thing you learned from doing this kind of work?
Just how to relate to people. You get very well talking to different facets of life, you know, different people. I think all, even street cops should work the jails. You'll learn how to talk to people. I mean, you don't have no gun on you. There's guys in the towers with guns, but you don't have no gun on you. So you got to learn to talk different, the mentally ill, every walk of life, you learn to talk to them, you know. So I think it would be a great benefit if every law enforcement officer, even on the street, work the jails, because they would definitely, I know the sheriffs do, but they would definitely get to, you learn how to talk to people.
It's an interesting talk, interesting career.
Thank you.
All right, Ralph, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you.
All right.